So thank you very much for spending the time with us this afternoon to talk about understanding and troubleshooting the Link VDI scenarios. So I am Lester Hewitt, one of the Link architects in the Enterprise Communications Center of Excellence, and I think we've self-awarded ourselves the longest name in Microsoft Services.
I'm Kaushal Mehta. I've been with Microsoft for over 4 years now. And my day-to-day responsibilities involve working with the TAP customers on bugs and feedback, and working with the product group for the same.
Hey everyone, my name's Tony. I'm a product line manager at VMware. Yes, I said it, VMware. I want to thank Kaushal and Lester for inviting me here to present with them today. So my responsibilities at VMware, I drive all the remoting technology to take the VM to the client endpoint. So that obviously includes this display protocol, PCIP, as well as all the remoting technologies, multimedia, the UC integration with Microsoft Link, as well as Cisco Avaya, and as well as a lot of the other technologies such as USB.
Thanks very much. So what are we going to cover off with you today? So really the idea around this is to spend some time just understanding what the Microsoft Link 2013 VDI plugin is, how we pair between the local machine and the remote virtual machine, and then to really dig into some of the scenarios for troubleshooting, some of the things that we've learned collectively over the last 18 months of working with this technology that hopefully will help you to sleep a bit easier at nighttime. We want to understand really what we should look at, what are the thought processes involved, what tools should we use to really get you to a better troubleshooting position. And hopefully the takeaways from this is that you'll feel more comfortable with this technology. You'll be able to troubleshoot those issues fast, and you'll end up with much happier and really smiley customers. So really, that's where we're going to go. From an agenda point of view, we're going to start off by just talking through what the VDI plugin is and how it works, talking through the pairing process. We're going to run through some troubleshooting methodology. We're going to pull four scenarios to walk you through of things we've commonly seen in the field, go down to the log level, look at some of the issues, look at how they were fixed. Hopefully, these things you can take away. We'll have a quick recap about VDI and QoS, some things you may have been thinking about if you're going to be deploying Link VDI and you're in a QoS environment. We're going to talk about some busts and myths, to use one of the old American programs, looking at some VDI myths that we hear time and time again, how we're going to bust those, and then really finish up with Tony giving us some really good insights into his view of the world from VMware. So hopefully it's kind of an action-packed agenda for you as we go through the day. So let's start off with thinking about virtual desktop infrastructure. So just a quick show of hands, who here has got some virtual desktop infrastructure of some format running? Fantastic, we'd hope that's the audience that's come here. So the idea behind virtual desktop infrastructure is really allowing customers to deliver desktops and applications and to meet a number of key business requirements, whether those business requirements are to keep compliance, to keep the data in the data center, whether there's some additional business compliance that may be around business continuity, maybe around rapid migrations from XP, may also be around some very specific requirements of their applications and their licensing models. So there's a number of different reasons why people are looking at the virtual desktop infrastructure route. And we're going to focus here very much on virtual desktop infrastructure compared to the sort of session-based services. So just kind of focusing on those areas. So let's think about how this starts to work within the Link world. So we're going to use some terminology here just to level set. There's a couple of blog items that Kaushal's written and things that I've contributed to, and we're trying to use very consistent language when we start to talk about virtual desktop infrastructure, because we find that there's sometimes confusion in the terms, and that itself sometimes makes it more difficult to troubleshoot a system. So what we're saying here on the left-hand side of the screen, this is really something you might call an access computer, thin client, repurposed machine. We're going to use the term of local machine, being local to the physical end user. And on the right-hand side, we're going to talk about virtual machines, the remote machines that basically are going to be running those desktop services for that user, just so we level set on this idea of local machines and remote machines. Okay with that? Cool. Good. Okay. So let's think about what the Microsoft Link 2013 VDI plugin was designed to do. So if we think about the challenges that we have, if you look at the typical kind of VDI workloads of the day, what we're looking is we're delivering sort of the standard office applications, we're delivering line of business applications that are hosted in the data center, and we're really delivering those kind of screen updates and the control sequences backwards and forwards between the local machines, the remote machines. You know, we're achieving that business requirement of keeping the data in the data center. We're also probably achieving some of the business requirements around how we make sure that we control information leakage. But it's very much a technology which was designed around the kind of the ability that, you know, it wasn't really looking at real-time media. So what we've done now is we took a number of customers were asking, okay, well, we actually really like this link thing, and we're also going down the VDI route. What can you do to help things and make us work forward? So how many people here went down the Link 2010 and the USB redirection and IP phone route? A couple of people. So that was an interesting trip that you shared. One person in the room has shared. So this is hopefully making that a lot easier to deliver a much better and more richer functionality with a lot more of the modalities in there. So, you know, it's about making sure that we support that real-time media. It's about making sure that we really kind of give this idea of dealing with potentially managed and unmanaged endpoints, maybe some people reusing some of their existing PCs. It's about making sure that we understand that, you know, there may be limited bandwidth between the thin clients themselves and the data center. So what we really want to avoid doing is sending real-time media up over a very long transit path. If we've actually got two people sitting in the same building wishing to have an audio call or a video call or a media call between them. So by trying to look at how we can get that media closer to the local machine should deliver a better experience for the end users that are using these type of technologies. And then obviously the other one to look at is external access scenario. So I think when we were talking about planning this session, we talked about some of the beta test engineering that Kausha was involved in. And for many of the early kind of tap engagements, probably the majority of the end users were actually outside in the outside world. So accessing this service over kind of remote desktop hosts and over the edge scenario. So it's good to see that that's something that's been tested as well with this. So hopefully, a few of you may have seen this diagram before. Anybody, can you put your hands up if you have seen it before, just so I get an idea? Good, excellent, okay. So the idea behind this is just to get an idea of how does this remote desktop and virtual VDI client actually work. So we've got real two main components that we care about. So on here, on the right-hand side, we've got our virtual machine, Windows 7, Windows 8, running quite happily. We've deployed the standard Link 2013 full client on this. On the left-hand side here, we've got our local machine, our access device, and here we're basically on the left-hand side, we've got a Windows 7 or 8 endpoint, maybe Windows 7 embedded, maybe a Windows 8 endpoint. On there, we've deployed the Microsoft Terminal Services client RDP8 components, and we've deployed the Link 2013 VDI plugin. So a couple of interesting things about deploying that plugin. How many people here have kind of got through the installation and have got a kind of, this isn't going to install out of disk space error? Okay, so a couple of little tricks that are worthwhile thinking about. If you're going to start deploying the VDI plugin, you're starting in your test labs, you're building your reference images up, and you're running on sort of Windows endpoints and thin client machines, it's a good idea to extract the Link VDI plugin to a USB stick and install it from there. Otherwise, what's going to happen is when you run the install, it's going to start chewing up a whole lot of disk space, and you've probably only got a gig in the DOM of some of these Windows 7 machines. So a good idea is to try and make sure the VDI endpoint or the install files, extract them first, then run the install off a USB file, and you have a much happier day. Because there's nothing more frustrating than starting on day one of this, and you can't even get the thing installed. So there's some hints and tips that are useful from there. So the idea behind this is that what we're looking at doing here, basically, is we are effectively pairing the VDI plugin on the left-hand side with the full Link client running on the remote virtual machine on the right-hand side, so that when we are using the full Link 2013 client in our remote virtual machine, we are doing all the controls, all the experiences, just as if we're using a standard local client. But the key point is that the actual media is being processed locally on my local endpoint, keeping it much closer to me, not having to deal with effectively the kind of laws of physics between where my endpoint might be, where my VDI environment might be in my data center. So if I take a scenario here of user A and user B, so user A running on the Windows 7 or 8 virtual machine with their Link plugin on their local access device, they plugged into that their USB headphone, they plugged into their webcam. You've got user B working on perhaps a standard Windows 7, Windows 8 machine. So when we have that media call between user A and user B, that media is now running from the local machine to the user B machine. It's not going up to the data center. It's not being processed by the VDI backend. So that's really key to understand. If you've done a lot of planning and you've worked on, say, 10 or 20 or 30 users per CPU on your backend on the VDI infrastructure, what you don't want to do is move all that real-time media onto that backend, because that means you're down to kind of one-to-one, which really isn't a very good business case for VDI. So this was really designed to take into account those challenges, move those forward. Okay, so I'm going to hand over to Kaushal, who's going to take us through the pairing process of how these things join together.
Thanks, Lester. So how many of you have seen pairing issues? Okay, a lot of you. So hopefully through this slide, we'll be able to better explain how the whole pairing process works and how we can troubleshoot it better. Lester and I, we actually spent a lot of time on this slide because we weren't really sure, how we should present it properly and make it very easy to, for the audience to digest. So we'll start with the local machine. So that's a terminology we are going to use to refer to the access machine or the thin client. It will be called local machine. From user perspective, there's a VDI plugin, and this plugin is actually not like a full desktop client. It's just installed, and it's not visible to the user. Once it's installed, it's continuously listening for the DVC connection request, dynamic virtual channel connection request. And again, this is not visible to the user. So at this point, the user has the local machine, and he's going to RDP into the remote machine. And once the remote machine is launched, the user would be launching the full desktop client. And once that desktop client is launched, we have, the desktop client is obviously going to search for the link server. And we have a logic in the client code that will actually make the client understand that it's installed on a remote machine and it's not on a non-RDP machine or non-remote machine. So once the client signs in and signs in successfully, you will see that the desktop client, once it signs in and it knows that it's in a remote machine, there's a logic that will actually do a DVC connection request with the VDI plugin. So the plugin was waiting for the connection request to come in, and at this point, it has received the connection request. As soon as it gets it, the plugin will actually talk with the desktop client, and it will tell the desktop client that, give me the credentials. At this point, the user would actually see the VDI credential prompt. I hope you guys are familiar with that. And this credential prompt will actually come up for the first time, and once it's done, it won't actually come up again because the credentials are cached locally. So once the user gets the prompt and enters the credentials, the plugin, the full desktop client will send it back to the plugin. Plugin will get the credentials. It will use the user name. It will use the domain part of that. Using the domain piece, it will discover the link server. At this point, the plugin is going to sign in to the link server using the credentials. Once it's signed in, so till now, the pairing hasn't actually finished. But once it has signed in successfully, the AV devices on the local machine, they are actually paired using the TPCP channel, which is the third-party control protocol. It's a custom code written between the plugin and the desktop client. And once that's done, the pairing is completed. So as you can see, the whole media processing is done using the plugin on the local machine. It's like a stripped-down client, and it's not visible to the user. So any questions around the pairing? Yep. So this example is just for RDP, but it can be RDP, it can be PC over IP, or it can be ICA, Citrix ICA. It can be, this is just to explain the overall pairing process. Any questions? Yep. No, so this is actually over RDP itself. Okay. This is over RDP itself. This is not going outside of, even the DVC connection, it's all over RDP when it's using the MSDSE or PC over IP or ICA, depending on what you have. ICA, Citrix is still not certified, VMware is, so it's PC over IP. Any questions on pairing? This is actually the key to the whole VDI plugin environment, and we see a lot of issues. We have, like, so far in last 1 year or so, we have seen a lot of issues with pairing. Yep.
So I see the two signs. Where is the authentication actually happening to the link server with their SIP ID and domain credentials?
At two places, for link desktop client as well as the plugin, both sides, yes.
So you have the sign-in happen over here before they were presented with their part over there, or?
So, once the user has launched the desktop client and has entered the credentials, again, using the user @domain piece, the client will do a discovery. and then find the link server, and it will sign in. Once it's signed in, the client has a logic to actually send a DVC channel request. And that's when the plugin will tell the desktop client that, you don't give me the credentials. I want to sign in as well. That's when you see the credential prompt.
The second sign-in is seamless then?
It's not visible to the user. So the whole VDI plugin piece is not visible to the user. From user perspective, the user will just see the desktop client signed in, and there is a checkbox on the bottom right that...
Is the second sign-in simply a register, or is it actually having you authenticate against the link server a second time?
It's a SIP register. So if you look at the UCC API, it's like a SIP register, okay. Yeah. But it won't be actually like challenging because, Good questions, yeah. Yep.
So, should we cover that on our myth-busting thing? So if you can hold that one for the time, Ben, that's a myth that we want to talk through.
Okay. Yep. I'll move on. Okay. So again, the pairing process slide was more to explain, you know, how the whole pairing works. But the key here from our session is to explain the troubleshooting and to make sure we have logging in place for all those different paths. So again, the local machine, the plugin is there. It's not visible to the user. It's waiting for the DVC connection request. At this point, there is nothing that's going to happen, like from failure perspective. If the user is not able to sign in to the RDP, I mean, that's not really pairing. So that's, again, an IT or a user side issue. So that troubleshooting would have to be done before calling Microsoft. Once that's done, once the user is signed in, he launches the link desktop client. And if that sign-in fails, then it's again not pairing, because at this point, the pairing, the DVC connection request has still not kicked in. So this is again like just like troubleshooting any other sign-in issue. So for that, we have the UCC API logs that will tell you, you know, at the SIP level what happened. If the SIP level is not even showing up, then you can just start with the network capture and look at the DNS and, you know, look at the SSL. You can always start with the test connectivity portal as well. Let's say the user has signed in properly. At this point, the desktop client, as I mentioned earlier, it has a logic to figure out that it's in a remote environment, so it will send in a DVC channel request. And this is supposed to work. I mean, we don't see any failures here, so the user won't even see the failure here either. Once that's done, the credential prompt comes up. Now, this prompt, if that doesn't come up, the login component for this, actually, we don't have anything like showing up in the UCC API or network capture. For that, we have to use the client-side ETL. And we have not shown it here because that's something that has to be provided to the Microsoft engineer, because the ETL has to be converted into a text format using our internal SysTools symbols. So that will help us to see, you know, why that credential prompt is not coming up. We'll have a few more scenarios that will actually help troubleshoot that one. Let's say the credential prompt comes up, and then the user enters it, and it's passed on to the plugin, and the plugin is going to sign in fine. But let's say after this, the pairing with the AV device, which is our end goal, right? If that fails, then again we have to look at the ETL and also the UCC API as well as the network capture from the plugin perspective. So the client on the VDI plugin on the local machine also has its own UCC API, as well as, of course, you can take network capture. So that will help us to see, you know, why exactly the final pairing didn't happen, why that green checkbox, you know, on the full desktop client didn't show up. So this is, you know, more to explain like how we can troubleshoot, how we can grab the logs, how we can analyze it. You want to talk about the file that actually...
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the other thing to say with this is that obviously if you're going to look on your thin client, typically if you look at your Windows thin client machines from the likes of Wise and Lenovo and HP, you're setting the disk to be non-persistent. You're wanting to make sure if there are any changes on the actual thin client machine, when that machine reboots, you're back to where your known point, which would mean if you're doing troubleshooting and then you've allowed the thin client to reboot, ain't getting anything there. So it's quite important also to realize that before you fire up the Microsoft Terminal Services client and start that pairing process, there actually isn't a logging folder. So it's only when that process starts to fire up and you can start to look inside Windows, Office, Link, tracing, and you'll start to see the file. So it can be very ephemeral. So it's a very good idea that if you do have problems with this troubleshooting, you know, you need to get hold of those logs before that thin client machine is rebooted. So then sometimes that can be a challenge because actually you've locked the thin client machine down to stop people getting at the underlying operating system. So some things you might have to think about in your own troubleshooting processes, how to get some of this information off that thin client machine.
Good stuff. Thank you. Any questions on pairing process, troubleshooting this? So the troubleshooting methodology is to cover some of the scenarios that we have seen and how exactly we can troubleshoot faster or debug or isolate the problem. The first one is the IAM and presence. So with IAM and presence, as Lester mentioned, that traffic is actually flowing between the remote machine and the front end directly. It's not involving the VDI plugin. So to start with, we can always make sure, you know, that the IAM and presence, if presence is not changing or if IAMs are failing, you know, make sure if that actually works in a non-VDI scenario or between, you know, completely like non-VDI users. Verify that other users, you know, other VDI users also see this. So that way you can isolate to, you know, just that user or whether it's applicable to all VDI users. Being internal versus external is always key to troubleshoot any link issue. Because being external means that it's going to involve the edge server, and edge server means it gets a little complicated. So try to see if it's applicable to just internal users or external users or you know any user. You can always use the test CS synthetic transactions. Those are actually PowerShell commandlets, and you can use those to make sure you know like just do a basic sanity on IAM and presence. For voice setup. Voice is actually critical here because the whole VDI plugin, as Lester mentioned, is actually to cover voice and video. We cannot do voice and video seamlessly in a remote scenario because of performance and other issues. So for voice setup, to start with, in 2010, we were actually asking the customers to have a IP phone on the local machine, so that way the IP phone will do the media redirection. So make sure, like for 2013 scenario, the IP phone is not required. Hence, you know, the users have to actually remove just disconnect the phone. Yeah.
Are you talking about USB connection between the phone and thin client, or?
Yes. So that's no longer required for 2013. Okay. That's no longer required because the plugin will take care of So two as in the desktop client, VDI, or VDI and the phone?
VDI and the phone, just as two separate endpoints, it's just MPOM, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the point with that is that if you looked at what Link 2010 was doing, it's actually using USB direction for the better together story.
Yeah.
So that when you're in the Link client on the remote virtual machine, that's when you're driving that local better together phone. What we're saying with 2013 is that scenario isn't supported. You don't need that, but you can still have your IP phone if you want it sitting there next to you, but you're not going to drive it from that virtual machine anymore. So that's the change in the scenario, because now we can actually use media devices directly on the thin client without having to basically have that IP phone anymore.
Yeah, and also, I mean, like if we see any issues with that type of scenario, I think the troubleshooting or from support perspective, from official support perspective or, you know, fixing the bug, I think that would make it a little difficult. Because it has not been supported since it was not required, so it may work fine. You know, it will be like a third registered endpoint from front end perspective. Yeah. So next, so this is actually again critical because if you verify that the same voice call works fine in a non VDI scenario, then you know that issue is you know actually like due to some VDI environment or you know due to that local machine. And then in a VDI scenario, as we saw in the earlier slides, the media directly flows between the local computer and the link user or local computer and MCU or the edge server, depending on which scenario it is. So through this, you can actually see the ICE candidates. You can look at the SDP, and you can make sure that you know those IP port ranges are actually all correct. So that can help sanitize, you know, do a sanity check. Also with voice call, I mean, like just saying like voice call is not working, you have to actually figure out whether it's like peer-to-peer voice call, whether it's a PSTN call, because the call path, the media candidates would be different when it's a PSTN call. It will involve mediation server. If it's a conferencing, then it's MCU that is involved. Or if it's with federated, then it's actually a little bit more complicated because you'll have edge server from your environment as well as edge server from a federated partner. So checking those things actually can help, you know, isolate the exact issue for VDI. For video, it's similar to voice, except that with video, what we have seen is like I had a case with a beta customer where they had a laptop with a built-in camera and it was docked, and also they had a USB camera on the top of the monitor, and the laptop was actually docked and the lid was closed, and somehow the plugin actually paired with the built-in camera. So we actually since then we have started actually telling that just have one AV device enabled through the control panel through device manager.
Does the VDI plugin redirect the default audio and video devices from the local device? Isn't that how that works? So in that scenario,
it's going to work with the ones that are identified as the communication devices. So if you've got a Windows 7 endpoint, you start to look inside the media stack, you see you've got the default audio, you've got the UC-enabled devices. So if you look at some of the vendors, they will actually equip their thin clients with an audio stack inside them. Then if you're going to plug in an optimized device like an optimized headset or an optimized webcam, because they're optimized, they're automatically defaulted to be the default communications devices, and those are preferred by the plugin. If you have nothing else, it'll take whatever on the device. That's been my experience anyway so far.
I'll also share a preference list that I have, because when troubleshooting this, actually, I was wondering like what preference the client has in picking over devices. Like, let's say if you have a video camera that also has audio, and then you have a USB headset as well, which one is picked up? So then I came to know from the developers, from the designers, that there's a preference. It's in my email. I'll share it with you after this. Thanks. So yeah, the goal here is to make sure you have just one device enabled, and not going into a scenario where it will just fail. So again, the same thing as video, just make sure that this scenario also works, or verify that it works in a non-VDI scenario. And it's similar to voice as well. Check the candidates for voice and video, it's still similar. And for video, check if it's peer-to-peer or if it's going through conferencing or federated, because the paths would be different. For audio-video quality, always start with the monitoring server data, even though it's VDI. The server will also have the reports for that, because the media is flowing from the local machine. And verify if other AV applications are also experiencing any quality issues. So on the local machine, you can see if audio-video for other applications outside of Link are seeing any issues, any quality issues. And then try to localize this to a set of users or region. So that will help, if you have multiple data centers, if you have users across the world, you can see whether it's the quality is just isolated to a specific region. Checking the CPU utilization actually sometimes help, because on the local machine, if the quality is poor, you can always look at the CPU and try to correlate what exactly is wrong. The geometry of the video size, you can see if the user is doing anything with that. So those things are, few things that you can actually do to help isolate the issue. For desktop application sharing performance, it's again similar. Check if it's in a non-VDI scenario, and you can look at the monitoring server reports as well. Check if it's just peer-to-peer or conferencing, this is actually a good sanity check, because I had a case and I had to ask the user. Actually, he was a CIO, and I had to ask him if he can actually play a video on the remote machine. Because for desktop sharing, as Lester mentioned in his slide, the desktop sharing traffic is between the remote machine and the other endpoint. It's not between the local machine. So checking the bandwidth on the remote machine actually helps with that. With this knowledge, let's dive into the scenario one and go deeper into the logs.
Okay, cool. So thank you very much.
Sure.
Can throw that back again. There's a couple of other points that Kaushal touched on as well when he started talking about looking at the CPU utilization of the local machine. So remember, the media is being processed locally on that local endpoint. So if you've got a Windows thin client machine with a single ultra low voltage CPU, I would be kind of starting to question about what kind of quality you're going to get from a video call. You're probably going to get a decent audio call. Video may be something that could be challenging, especially if users start to draw that up to a big screen. And again, you know, there you've got the ability to start using some of the user policies to start to define what it is that user group can actually do, to see what is the use case, and to see how important video is for that set of users compared to how good audio quality is. So I wanted to take you through some examples of kind of, you know, pairing failing, things not behaving themselves. So this is, I'm going to take you through three, and Catherine's going to take you through one. So common one for me is, okay, I've done the whole sign-in piece. I've gone to my local machine. I've signed in to Microsoft, the Terminal Services client. I've connected to my remote VDI host. I've got Link fired up. I've signed in. Everything's working beautifully. I look in the bottom right-hand corner, and there is a big zilch. Anybody seen this one before? Yeah, okay. So this means you actually get nothing in there. So how are we going to go away and see if we can find out what's going on? So one of the things we talked about was some of the logs. And the place that I would recommend starting is going to be looking inside the local UCC API log, which is on the local machine. So let's have a little crack into that one and see what we can see inside there. So this is why I kind of put at the beginning, if you want to come and see us a bit closer, you can all come forward. So what we're going to look at here is some logs that we've taken out of a couple of environments. And we're going to have a look at, let's drop it into Snooper, and trying to sign ourselves back into the hotel Wi-Fi, but anyway, that's what it was. There's nothing else. Phew. So, exactly, and unfortunately not a lot has happened in Vegas so far. We were up doing LRS stuff till quite late last night, but anyway. So what I'm looking at here is a typical kind of Snooper log coming through here. So, you know, I've got my standard things that I expect to see. So I'm getting my kind of, you know, we're talking about, are you going to be authenticated again? So we get the three tries we go through to make sure I'm going to be running through authentication. And eventually we have to see the sort of authentication methodologies I'm going to be using. So what I'll be looking for here is I'm going to be looking to see, okay, well, that there's something very important that Link does when it starts up. It actually gets given a whole bunch of provisioning information. And that provisioning information is the instantiation of all of the client policies that you've set up. And very nicely for me is I know that a key client policy that I have to set if I want to enable VDI is enable media redirection. So one of the first things I'd like to look at, if I see a client that just does not pair at all, my first step is, let's go and have a look inside that log. Oh, look, somebody's typed it in there for me already. Fantastic, as if by magic. And I've got my one SIP 200OK response, which is actually my application provisioning information. And if I scroll down through this little lot, I can see quite happily, nicely highlighted in yellow for me, because Snooper's really doing a good job, I've got enable media redirection false. So that's basically telling the Link client in the remote machine not to engage the pairing process. And that's why I get that nice little empty thing in the right-hand corner. So how do we go around and fix this? Because it'd be nice to fix it rather than just giving you a problem. So simple fix this one. I'm going back into my Link machine. I've realized that the client policy that is applied to my user doesn't have that setting enabling media redirection being true. So I go find my VDI user's client policy. I run this bit of PowerShell. There we go. And then I effectively have fixed it. And then, yay, I get a nice green icon next time the guy signs in. Okay, so that's a really kind of key one, starting to understand how the architecture works, how the different bits of the plugin work together, gives you a key area of where to start looking for the logs and which bits to start going through. So let's move on to something that's a little bit more complicated. This is the one that has frustrated me for some times in the past, where I do get in the bottom right-hand corner of my Link client that pairing icon, but I see it pulsing. It just carries on pulsing, and the pairing process never actually takes place, and never finishes. So let's have a look at what we can do to start to investigate how that might be happening. And again, I'm going to be using the UCC API log off the local machine to see what's inside there. So let's come out from that one. Now, and then some people might even get an idea what the problem might be, guessed on the names of the log files, but hey-ho. So what I would do with this one is when I start to look at these log files, you know, there's two different ways I can use Snooper, or I can actually use the standard Notepad. Depending on what I'm looking for, I actually sometimes just stay within Notepad because I find it easier to search and easier to look through. As you start to get more comfortable with these logs at looking at VDI troubleshooting, or just getting comfortable with how it works normally, you'll see that through the logs there are a number of areas of errors and warnings that are mainly benign. And when you're going through them, you know, it's looking at does that process continue after a benign error, or does it just stop and sort of retrench? So when I'm looking through these logs, I'm looking to, if there is an error, does it carry on going? Does it carry on doing what I think it should be doing? Or where is the point where it actually just stops and the whole process just falls over? So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to start to have a little search for the word error, which is obviously useful. And what I've got is I've got some interesting ones here that I find to do with my an API result. Now, those people that have looked for these logs will see that one appearing quite often. That's relatively benign. So I'm going to move through to basically seeing, oh, failed to convert IP address. Maybe there's something going on inside there. So what I want to look at here, some DNS information. It's quite interesting to look at. We want to look at here, coming down a bit further. There we go. Something interesting that probably would be giving me something to worry about here. Error, secure socket negotiation failed. Work item post of TLS negotiation. So I'm getting a very clear error that I probably have something wrong with my certificates. Who said that? Who brought that one out? There we go. There you get a voucher for the chap there. There we go. See, you should have been looking at it. Anybody should have said untrusted certificate. There you go, Maris. That's all right, no worries. So the idea behind this is basically, so we've got an idea on a serious note that here we've got something going on with TLS, and there could be a number of errors inside of here. Typically, if you think about how thin clients are deployed, they're maybe deployed into a work group, so they're not going to inherit the certificate authority from Active Directory, so it's probably highly likely that what's happened is I'm not trusting the certificate that the link server is presenting to the VDI plugin, and therefore the process is failing. And what I can actually see if I scroll down a bit further into this log, because I'm actually at the end of the log now, so I kind of know that this is probably where the problem is going to be occurring, I can start to see that it's basically coming back, you know, releasing connection, retrying, and then I'm getting this idea that everything is starting to close back down again. So in the case of going to fix that one, then the way I would go through and do that is I'd be looking at my certificates, and on this case, basically, we've realized that you know, I need to make sure that I have installed the root certificate authority and the various bits of the chain to get through that one. So it's again where you're going to need to have a look through the logs, start to see what are the obvious things inside there, because that pulsing little I'm just trying to carry on pairing just carries on there for quite some time. So it's nice to kind of get an idea of what's going on with that. So we fix that, we pair. Brilliant. So this next one absolutely drove me around a bend. I think I was at the point of almost biting lumps out of my desk when I found this one the first time. So if I can share this with you and it saves you a few hours with the 30 or 40 people in the room, that's got to be some goodness, I would suggest. So hopefully we can save you some time with this as well. A little bit of history with this. Hopefully most of you are fully aware of the difference between the way that clients discover the Link service between Link 2010 and Link 2013. So in Link 2010, we had to take great care about SRV records, and we had to make sure that SRV record, basically, that when we looked at that SRV record, look at the SIP records, we had to make sure that all of the user's SIP domain was properly represented in the target of the SRV record. Because otherwise what would happen is the Link 2010 client would go, I don't really trust where you've sent me, do you want me to continue? And you got that nice little pop-up, and you could say, yeah, I want to continue, and everything was fine. The problem is that the Link 2013 Link VDI plugin doesn't have that nice little pop-up. So here's the first clue to what will be going on. Second thing to look at is how Link 2013 clients do server discovery. So those of you that have deployed the mobile clients and the modern clients will have worked out that actually one of the things you have to get going is you need to get this Link Discover and Link Discover internal records in play, because you're leveraging the auto discover and discovery services so that your mobile clients can find your UCWA server. And there's a great blog by Jeff Schertz, which really goes into huge detail about looking at this. It's a recommended read to understand what's going on at that point. The problem with this is that it will return the FQDN of the user's home pool or server. And if you've got a different SIP domain to your internal Active Directory domain, what will happen is the Link VDI plugin says, wait a minute, it's Lester.hugh at a cheeky beer monkey, and you've given me Link Server 1 on internal.local. Cheeky Beer Monkey is what I expect. If you give me linkserver1.cheekybeermonkey.com, I'd be happy. But because the server name, FQDN part, domain part, doesn't match my SIP domain, that is an untrusted environment, and I will stop working. Now, the reason why this drove me around the bend is because in my environment at the time, I only had the SRV records in play, and my VDI environment was working beautifully. And then when I started to get more involved in mobility and looking at the mobile clients, I updated my environment, And I've had a few customers that have gone down exactly this same route. They put this Link Discover services in because they wanted to get the modern clients running, the mobile clients running, and their VDI stuff stopped working. And I went round and round and round in circles on this one. It's only when I started to think about, okay, well, what could possibly be going on? What has started to change? I started to really dig into a lot more of the network logging to start to understand what was going on. So let's take you through that process, show you what we found, and hopefully that could save you a load of problems. So things I'll look at, again, that local log, and I'm going to look at the local machine traffic.
Question.
Yeah. Yes, the normal link client would, but the link VDI plugin, because it's a headless, that there really isn't any UI access down there. It doesn't have that UI to pop up. And so, yes, it gets a bit interesting. So let's start looking, first of all, let's look at the local UCAPA log. So effectively, make sure I've got the right one. Yeah, it's going to be that one. Okay, so here is my log from my local machine, and it kind of stops after 15 lines. Really, it's if you compare this to a absolutely working properly link, it's line for line is perfect. There's nothing in there to indicate you've got an issue. It comes up and says, I'm sharing presentity data. Okay, I'm ready for this. Nice connection. And it just stops. The log doesn't produce any other information. So then if you've exhausted that endpoint, then you start to look at what's going on the link server itself. And effectively what you're seeing there, as far as the link server is concerned, it's getting information from the link client in the virtual machine, and the logs there look perfect. So that doesn't really help you either. So unfortunately, you have to crack out your favorite blend of network sniffer. I've used Netmon here. Anybody here actually been playing with a new message analyzer rather than Netmon? Okay, a couple of people. It's a great, I think this kind of troubleshooting where you could apply some of those filters and some of those pre-canned kind of intelligent pieces you can build yourself would be great from a community perspective to get out there and start to run through this and try to treat this up. So what I'm going to do here is I'm actually going to put in a filter for DNS entries. And what I've got going on down here, which is kind of how I eventually track this down, is, I don't know if you can see here, I can see that actually what it's my last DNS query is for link13standard.internal.local. So I kind of knew that I was cheekybeermonkey.com. That was the last query I made. And I started to realize, actually, what's happening is my Link VDI client is getting back a server and FQVN it doesn't trust, and that's what's stopping the process. So, you know, that it was a fairly painful couple of days trying to get to the end of that one, but we got there in the end. And again, the fixing of it is relatively painless, one might say. So what we need to do here is we need to leverage the trusted server model, trusted data model, registry keys. What we're doing basically is we are putting in the FQDNs of the internal Active Directory domains that host link servers. So we are telling the link VDI endpoint to trust those domains and run them through. So you can either do that basically with a local policy, you can burn it into the thin client configuration, or if you're doing AD integrated thin clients, you can basically drop them in via group policy, which is probably the simplest way of doing that. So hopefully, once you've done that, we get pairing working again.
Does that go on the current user or the actual local machine?
So I've had more success with it going into the local machine rather than the current user, let's put it that way. Theoretically, it should go in both. The other thing to be really key about is that when you, and the articles have been updated now, when I was looking at this probably 8-9 months ago, or a little longer than that ago, all of the public documentation that told you where the registry key goes was the Office 2010 keys, which aren't the same for Link 2013. So the first time we tried to put it in, it just didn't accept it either, because it's actually looking in the wrong place. So on Casual's troubleshooting blog, we've actually got exactly where to look for this and which keys to put in and what registry to use. So, you know, we try to go into a great lot of detail in there to help you through some of those areas. Okay, so we're going to talk about video now.
Yep, thanks. Thanks, Lester.
Thank you, Casual.
So scenario 1 through 3, where more about like pairing is failing, scenario 4 is about pairing has established fine, but video is not available to the user. So symptom that we saw actually was that user A can see, so once the user A and user B are connected in a P2P voice call or video call, user A can see user B's video, but user B cannot see user A's video. So starting with the symptom and trying to understand the scenario better, the first question actually to ask the customer, to the user, was that are both users in VDI session or not, or just one user is in VDI session. So in this case, in my case, when I was working with this customer, both users were in a VDI session. So I asked, user B cannot see user A's video, but can user B see his own video in the preview? And so that actually will at least tell you whether it's actually the ICE candidates or it's the stream or whether it's something to do with VDI. When I compared both users' hardware configuration, they were exactly same. Same laptop, same model, same everything, for the local machine, that is. And then they had up-to-date drivers as well, because that's one thing that you can always check when video, if you see any issue with the video. I checked the UCC API logs, I checked the SDP, I checked all the ICE candidates, it looked fine. So it didn't tell me anything that the video is failing, the stream is failing to display. And then, I also checked, as I mentioned earlier, whether if you have like two devices, have to make sure whether it's pairing fine. So in this case, I did make sure that it was connected with the fine, with the correct USB video device. Also asked, if like removing and adding it back changes it, or like repairing, will help. So as I mentioned earlier, if there are two video cams, then try disconnecting one of them, and you can do like basic troubleshooting. This is again like very end user type of troubleshooting. Repairing sometimes you can try, because repairing, just in case if the user has not connected the device when it was pairing for the first time, that will not establish the call. So repairing and asking the user if the device is connected, that can help to do sanity check. So user B was actually, so in this case, user B couldn't see user A's video. So on user B's machine, which is actually local or remote, I asked whether like playing videos from any other site actually is playing fine or not, and that was actually working fine. So there was no problem with playing video like natively in a browser. It was just with the link client when looking at user A. Any questions so far for the scenario? So to start, to further troubleshoot this, AM is actually the access machine one. It should have been actually LM, local machine one. So when local machine one, user B is RDPing into remote machine one, the symptom was that user B cannot see user A's video when in the call, and it cannot also see its own video preview. So I asked, whether the same user can use the same login and try RM2, which is remote machine two. So it's a different machine in the data center, just to make sure whether it's actually RM1 that is doing anything in the equation. So it's more about like attacking the problem using like variables and equation. So for this scenario, again, the symptom was same. User B couldn't see user A's video, as well as it couldn't see its own preview during the call. So I asked the user B to change his local machine and try connecting it to RM1. So at this point, yes, the user B was able to see user A's video as well as was able to see its own video preview. Then I made sure, just for my curiosity, I asked the user to try from AM2 with remote machine 2, and again it was the same. So we know there was something to do with access machine 1, with local machine 1. I checked the UCC API logs, ETL logs, checked the SDP candidates, checked the network capture, everything was fine. So the video feed was coming to user B's machine. And then after working with the product group, we had actually isolated this to a video rendering bug with RDP. So the way the video feed is actually displayed is actually over the RDP, and it's not as how a user would actually expect. It's actually the video feed that you see in a VDI session, it's actually played locally. But it moves in a way that the user will think that it's actually moving in the remote machine. So it's still on the local machine. So we involved the Windows 8 RDP team back then. This was like when Windows 8 was in TAP as well. And the customer was part of Link TAP, Link Beta, as well as Windows 8 Beta. So everything was pre-release code. So we involved the Windows 8 team and then collecting MSTSC log which actually we don't do from Link Themes perspective, but we did that, and then we figured out that the there was something with the geometry that was not correct. So after fixing that, the user has not seen the problem. So again, the goal here was to help you help isolate VDI issues faster. So any questions on this one? Yep.
Mm-hmm. It works, both users can see each other. But if you double click on the contact and then select the video icon in the chat window, mm-hmm. the video from user A doesn't send to B. It's
because of the preview. When you go to preview yourself, that pops up first when you're in that scenario. So when you put a click on that, your video will go through. If you wait, let the preview go down,
that's interesting, actually. I think we can sync up offline and grab. Sorry? You have seen this before?
Yeah, I'm using Zen app. And I've learned Zen app and I've learned Zen desktop.
So it's not certified yet, and we cannot disclose what's going on with that, but we can definitely know. For your case, it's RDP or whether it's VMware or?
It's in desktop.
Okay. So we cannot disclose what certification is there in the pipeline. When at this point, only VMware has been certified officially. So, troubleshooting point of view, you can try and make sure. Most likely, it would be the Link plugin or the RDP transport. So, back to you.
Thank you. Costs. So just a couple of we did promise this a couple of quick slides on troubleshooting quality of service. So, one of the things that we think is quite key is if you are going to go down the virtual desktop infrastructure route and you are looking to deliver a quality audio and video experience, it is a pretty good idea to, if you have got a Quoz-enabled network and you've deployed Quoz for your standard Link clients, then continue that configuration over onto your thin clients. So what we've got here, that the key learning point, and this is, again, something we learned from the field, was that obviously when we're looking at the local machine, there isn't a link.exe. So if you look at your standard ways of applying your diffserv marking via group policies, then we have to change it to mstsc.exe. So that's the first thing to look at. You actually would have to put some additional lines into your group policies. Again, what most people would tend to do is they would target their thin client estate with a different group policy than they do with their Link users. And you can put them in both, doesn't hurt, but it's just an idea of what's going through there. So very key to make sure that when you're setting up those group policies, that your target name is Microsoft Terminal Services Client.exe, not Link.exe, because there isn't a Link.exe, because it's a plugin. And I don't know why, but for me, it really kind of rammed it home when I realized that, yes, it's a plugin. It's not an individual client in its own right, a plugin to Microsoft Terminal Services Client. So the other thing to do then is obviously to just check that, make sure it is actually being applied. So here we've got another little capture from Netmon, and we can see quite happily that our DSCP market of 46 that we set up there that's running and being put in there. Again, other things to look at. Those of you who attended some of the SDN presentations this morning that my colleague Cornel was doing with Aruba, they were talking very much around it's great to mark traffic, but you still need to make sure with the network team that it's not being remarked and it's being stripped off. So it's a good idea just at least to make sure that on the thin client device itself that, you're going to either, some people might install a network monitor tool on the thin client box itself. Some of you might have to go out and find dusted away in the bottom of IP an actual hub. If you try and buy a hub now, anybody tried to do that for troubleshooting? Go and buy a dumb hub. It's pretty much impossible. It's eBay. That's the only way you're going to get one of those from there. So, so it's a good idea sometimes just to go and get one or two test machines just with. Now, you can install Netmon and a Link client on a standard kind of Windows 7 DOM thin client. They do fit quite happily. I've got a few of them running that. Okay, so we wanted to kind of talk a little bit next about, go back to one of the gentleman's questions earlier on about VDI pairing myths, things that we get asked time and time again, which we thought, hey, we can save ourselves 4 million emails over the next couple of years by just talking through these now. So a couple of things for us. So the first one we hear a lot is that, no, the VDI machine must be domain joined. Okay, well, let's look at the reality of that. No, that's not actually the case. So the VDI local machine can be domain joined. It can be work group joined. Basically, it works as well either or. The reality is going to be is if you do domain join your Windows thin client machines, then obviously then you can use group policy to manage them. So there's a management advantage to doing that. But from a technical perspective, it does not need to be domain joined. So next one is that basically the VDI local machine needs to be in the same forest as the link environment. No, that's not true either. So I've had deployments where VDI has been in one forest, link's been in another forest. I think you do need to be aware of those. You're going to have credentials that are valid in your link forest for this to work, which makes it more of a, it becomes more of a pain for the end user to sign on if you have to do that, but it's something to be aware of. So VDI local machine can have Link 2013 full client and the Link 2013 VDI plugin installed. That really is a very bad idea. So it's a really bad idea. Wouldn't suggest doing that. There's a kind of gray whether it's fully supported or not is an interesting piece, but every time I've seen that happening, that typically has caused some problems. There is a serious point to make here. There's some organizations, so if I look at some of the big banks I've dealt with in the past, some of the big banks have gone down a 64-bit or 32-bit or bus tunnel route, and there was interesting questions about whether they wanted to keep their, they decided that they were going to keep Office 32-bit, but they were going to keep their desktops at 64-bit. And as you're aware with this VDI plugin, you actually have to have the same bitness for the various components. So, you know, one of the things that isn't going to work is if you're going to try and install, so you might have Office 2010 32-bit, no link on there, on your local machine because you're working in a transitionary phase before you go to full VDI, and your customer may say, hey, I want this as a kind of fallback. Because you've got 64-bit desktop and 32-bit Office, when you try and install the 64-bit Link VDI plugin, which is what you have to do to match the OS bitness, that isn't going to work. So that's just something to have a little think about if you are in that transitionary phase and you're thinking, hey, you know, it's fine, we can keep 32-bit Office and 64-bit Link plugin. The installer says, no, that's the wrong bitness version and stops. So that's just another one that we learned along the way. And then the other one is very clear that when we say link video is played on the remote machine and sent over RDP, that's not the case. The media is always being processed locally and displayed on the local machine. And there's a very key thing. When you are setting up your link VDI endpoints, when you look at the public documentation, it's very clear about the settings for play on this machine or remote recording. It's really important you get those right. Because if you get those flipped back the wrong way, what happens is you actually get your audio endpoints dragged through RDP, and it all looks like it's working. There's no pairing plugin, but I can make audio calls. The quality of those audio calls is fairly poor because it's been running across RDP. So a lot of people go, this isn't working, doesn't do what it's supposed to do. First question I always ask is, have you set up those two pieces? Because typically they're not doing any pairing, they're just doing kind of RDP remoting, which is not what they also do. Okay, so we're going to, he's sitting very patiently here for the last hour, we're going to hand over to Tony, who's going to take us through troubleshooting VDI in the VMware environment. Great. There you go. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, guys. You guys did a great job.
Thank you.
So in my section, I'm going to focus specifically on just VDI pairing in a VMware VM environment. The guys did a great job explaining the pairing process end-to-end using RDP over for remote FX. So I'll just focus on Horizon View and the pairing process. The first thing I always start off with when I take calls with customers or partners is I ask them for their environment. Are they using a supported remote machine, operating system on the remote machine, as well as are they using a supported operating system on the client device? So as it stands today, the latest Vue release that we have is Vue 5.3, and that was released last October. And we only support Windows 7 SP1, and as your operating system for your virtual machine. And on the client endpoint, we support Windows 7, 8, and 8.1. And when you use that combination, we support the VDI pairing. For our customers that want to use 8.0 or 8.1 as their operating system for the remote machine, we don't support that today. We are currently working on it. I can't give a date at this point, but basically, it's probably going to be in the second half of this year. So a couple of things. How many of you have actually deployed Horizon View before? So two people. So the reason I'm asking is that I want to see how detailed I need to go into this. So essentially, just to lay out the components, on the remote machine, basically there's a piece of software called the View Agent, and that allows you to basically accept the connection from the view client, which is installed on the client device. On the client device, the user is going to launch the view client, and they're going to select the machine they want to connect to. It's going to connect back to the view agent, and they're going to enter their credentials. When they enter their credentials, basically, they're going to connect via PCIP. Once that session is established, it's not only going to establish the PCIP connection, but there's going to be a virtual channel that's established. What that virtual channel essentially allows this whole pairing process to do is it allows the link client that's installed on the remote machine to communicate and pair up with the link VDI plugin on your local client machine. One of the things we always ask, or I always get asked, is our customers ask what additional ports, whether it's TCP or UDP, need to be open to enable the communications. The simple answer is none. If you have a connection, a PCIP connection, basically, the virtual channel was already established. So basically, you don't have to add any additional firewall ports or anything, just allow the communications. So the Link VDI plugin, on your local client device, the only version that's supported is the 32-bit version of the Link VDI plugin. This is contrary to what is supported when using RDP, but the process for that is the reason for that is the PCIP process is only 32-bit. So if you're trying to use the 64-bit version of the Link VDI plugin, it's not going to be able to communicate over PCIP, so it's just going to fail. So we are looking into supporting that in the future, but it includes uplifting all the components, all the modules, if you will, and make it 64-bit, and we haven't done that yet. We do have plans, but I can't give a time frame at this point. So the Link 2013 client bit level, so this is referring to the Link client that you install on your remote machine operating system. In Vue 5.2, the client bit level has to match the client bit level or the operating system bit level. So if you had a 32-bit operating system, you had to install the 32-bit version of the Link client. If you had a 64-bit version or 64-bit operating system, then you had to install the 64-bit version of the Link client. And essentially, the reason for that was we made the assumption that if customers have a 64-bit operating system, they're going to install the 64-bit version of Office 2013 and thereby get the 64-bit version of the Link client. What we found after we released it is we had some customers, for whatever reason, I guess they had a 32-bit version of Office already, and they wanted to install it on their 64-bit version of their operating system. And as you guys probably know, right, the folder path for a 64-bit version of Office versus a 32-bit version of Office is different, right? So basically, we didn't lay out the DLLs necessary to support both folders, if you will. We only laid it on, if it's a 64-bit operating system, we laid it in the folder path for 64 bits. That's it. So we fixed that in Vue 5.3, and we just made the assumption that they may want to mix and match, so just lay that DLL in both folder paths. Question?
I was going to say, if you look at Microsoft documentation, they actually say don't use Office 64-bit ever.
Don't use Office?
It's regular documentation. It says don't use it unless you're using databases over 2 gigs for Excel.
Oh. I did not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Finally, so I talked previously about the pairing process and how the PCIP virtual channels is the communications channel that enables the Link client to communicate with the Link VDI plugin. Now, when you install your Vue agent on your remote machine operating system, you have to install PCIP. Once you install PCIP, it lays down all the bits and bytes necessary to enable the virtual channel. In a few instances, for whatever reason, we've seen a couple of customers go into the registry in HKey local machine software, and for whatever reason, they set the PCIP-enabled VChan to zero, which disables the virtual channel. So when that happens, basically, you're not going to have any communications between the link client and the link VDI plugin, and it's not going to even pair up. It's not going to pair up, right? So that's another place you can look. So let's say you you went through all the troubleshooting steps that Lester and Kashal covered, and you're still having problems. When you call into VMware tech support, they're going to ask you to enable the following logs on the view agent and the view client. So those are the paths in the registry where you can set it. You set the vChannel log to DWORD01, and essentially what that does is it enables verbose logging, and it collects the log necessary to monitor the virtual channel and see what's being sent over it. So if your link client is attempting to pair but fails for whatever reason, right, we're going to be able to see, is it initiating the proper calls and such. The log folders are going to be in user profile, app data, Microsoft Office tracing. So just send that over to your GSS technical supports engineer, and they can take a look at it and possibly provide you a remedy. So these are just a couple of reference links, links to how to install the link client on Horizon View desktops, as well as the community website. So that community is monitored by VMware engineers, the product managers, and so on. We use it to get information from our customers and partners, but we also get online and help them troubleshoot and ask them to collect logs and so on. So it's a very useful tool. So that wraps up my session. I wanted to open it up for Q&A.
Does it work your security server?
Yes, it does. Yeah. So the security server is connecting from.
Is it required to redirection
in that case, or is it just working on? It just works over. It does not require MMR. So what happens is when you're connecting from outside, the VMware PCIP session is sent through the security server, but in the DMZ, there's a link edge server, right? So that link VDI plugin, which is outside the corporate network, is going to communicate through the edge server. Yeah. So it won't go through the PCIP security server.
That's not something we can really talk about in this session, unfortunately. I wish that I could.
Do you know anybody who made something kind of a third party workaround?
I mean, I suppose if you look at where some of the partners have been for Link 2010, so if you looked at what Citrix have been up to, they had their HDX optimizer and their plugins, which again, the support of that is totally down to them. We can't comment on that. And so that was running on a Linux platform. And that ran on 2010. Now they, I suppose the concern around that was that it changed the user interface quite significantly and what it did. So if you had a user estate that moved from standard link clients to VDI and back, they kind of got a bit fed up because things weren't in the same place, didn't work the same way. So I think there always could be opportunities for third parties to work in that space, but it's going to be looking at, I suppose let me turn back a little bit. Another thing to think about with the non-Windows thin client space, it's quite a fragmented market, because that's where a lot of the thin client vendors differentiate themselves based on the fact that they write the OS. So it's not like the ones that run Windows where it's a consistent OS, we can write it once, we can test it. Once it ends up in that fragmented world, there's a whole load more engineering effort. So it's looking at, if somebody's going to move in that space, they've got a decision, what is the majority player in that space? And I don't think there is one at the moment. So I wish we could say more, but I think that's all we can really say.
If you can let your account team know, account team can work with the link experience, back experience team.
Yeah.
And we can take feedback and see how many customers are in non-Windows environment, and we can take the feedback to the product.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes,
it's definitely, I would definitely second that. I mean, let the account team know they can, there are tools which track kind of how many customers are trying to do this to try and get an idea of where's the majority's place, and that may help the decision.
How many users are not using Windows
yet?
Yep.
Yes,
because right now I think that it's preventing the enterprise voice programs.
Hmm.
Everybody's voice with VDA. The fact is that many organizations that use remote desktop scenarios or
But
they
have your Linux space to Linux space. Yeah. But then, so I mean, an adjunct to that scenario, I've seen a customer who, a couple of customers, and what they were doing is they actually were using the Link mobile clients to actually deliver voice over those. So they were using that because effectively, you know, they were also bringing that into a BYOD strategy, which is kind of really interesting. So they were trying to say, well, actually, you know, most of the people that are coming in to work for them in the industry they worked in have some kind of mobile device. And now with the support for iOS and for Android and for all the other bit different flavors, you know, pretty much most of what they were going to be walking in with probably has a Link mobile client. So you've also got to make sure that your Wi-Fi network is sized sufficiently and has all the clever controls on it around this, but actually delivering voice to that was also an option, you know, because then effectively it became, you know, it's run over Wi-Fi, it's not costing their end users anything BYOD, and it's allowing them to make all of those calls. So it's just another way of thinking about that as an opportunity. And it requires Windows.
Yeah. I can answer that for you. I spent many hours on the phone with Terry Ichi. The problem that we've run into is that the CPU power in the Zero clients just cannot match what's required to do the transcoding on those thin clients. As a matter of fact, we've been testing the HP T610s, and we use standard for our desktops 24-inch monitors. Those certified devices, Windows devices that are 1.5 gigahertz processors as well. When you do a full screen video, you have the full processing power of even that device. So we've actually just had to invest in the 620 quad core, 2 gigahertz. The 1.5 gigahertz would have been good enough. But to answer your cost on price, when you're talking about thin clients, that the price of those thin clients is surprisingly low. Pricing that we got was even lower than our Zero
clients. That's a good deal.
I think you pegged it right there. I mean, essentially, it's the lack of CPU horsepower necessary to do that local media processing. I mean, it is what it is today, right?
It is. Quick question. VDI plugin today has limited functionality with audio and video options in the Link client.
So gallery view and some of those areas.
Yeah. That's known, and I think we are tracking feedback on that one as well.
Okay, I dropped your feedback. I just didn't know if there was there was an ETA on that or if it's on the radar at all.
We don't have an ETA on that. But it's on the radar. It's on radar. Yeah.
Because that's actually holding up our enterprise deployment. We are 100% VDI. So I looks like our IAM presence will be coming into play first.
What's the customer name?
Blue Cross Blue Shield, Kansas City.
And number of seats, just
100.
100%. I'll make sure this gets sent out. Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you.
For the future, that's many customers in Europe have no desktop integration solution. Yeah, normally terminal server solution. Have you an idea that maybe we can switch the VDI client to a normal terminal server solution?
So I mean, the current support statement is that's not supported.
That is not supported today. Yeah, okay, but in the future.
So what I do know, and this is, you know, from personal experience rather than speaking on behalf of Microsoft, is that the firm I used to work for, we did some testing with some of the early Citrix pieces, and that the only way that would work was actually with their Citrix DVC beta, and it was ZenApp 6.5 HSRP1. So that was, you know, that was something that was working. As to what Citrix decide to support in that model is again down to them. So, you know, it will be, I mean, a VMware may want to work in that same area. So that, you know, once you move outside of that pure VDI scenario, which is the one that we've coded for and one we support, it's going to be where the partners want to play in that space as to where they want to move into more of an RDS rather than VDI. And that there are cases where VDI is the right solution for customers. There are cases where RDS is the right solution. But I think what we saw for the ask on the market, it was very much around VDI, it was dedicated remote virtual machines, that was the ask, rather than the kind of the terminal services side of things. I wouldn't be able to comment. I know for VMware View, basically you just replace it with the local VM View client.
Correct.
Yeah. So I mean, whatever that, I mean, fundamentally, you're using the Windows Packet Scheduler tool and a marking tool. So if you work out what the right XE is from the Citrix perspective, pop it into that, you should have the same experience. But I can't state what they're going to do with their technology. That's all. Cool. So I know we're standing between you and the attendee party, which is not a good place to be at this point in the afternoon, and we're about 5 minutes over. Well, 5 seconds over, that's not too bad, actually. So thank you very much for spending the time with the three of us. Thank you. Can we ask, please fill out those evaluations. Please fill them out. They're great. Thank you. Any other questions, please feel free to come up. Thanks, guys.